The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome to our Dharma Practice Day, continuing our series for the year on Anapanasati, or mindfulness of breathing. And it'd be a day of some teaching, some guided meditation, some meditation. Meditation is the focus. And I'm reminded that in the discourses of the Buddha, it is, not only does the Buddha teach there and have conversations with people, but you get a little bit of sense of his daily life, his daily schedule, and also of the daily life of his disciples, his monks who knew him and spent time. And one of the most common descriptions of the monastic daily life is they get up in the morning and they put on their robes and get their alms bowl, and they go into town and they collect their food for the day. They come back to camp, back to the monastery, and they eat it, their food, clean up, and then they go and spend the rest of the day meditating. They go and retreat someplace. It seems like they often went in seclusion, went off by themselves into the woods someplace. And then they would, the expression in Pali is, they went off for their day's abiding. To abide for the day, meaning in meditation. And then in the evening, they would come out of meditation, and they would, the Buddha would teach or have some encounter, or the other monastics would sometimes go and visit each other and have Dharma discussions. And then further descriptions would be at some point in the evening, they go back into meditation and spend a good part of the evening meditating, and then they'd go to sleep for a short, relatively, for our point of view, relatively short period of time. They'd get up early and they'd meditate some more, and then they'd start that cycle again. It's a pretty simple schedule. Meditate, eat, meditate, hang out, meditate, sleep, meditate. It goes around and around. So I don't know how it is for you, but for me, I get a very nice feeling of this lifestyle of people who then would kind of, spend big chunks of their day on retreat in the woods quietly. So here, a little bit. We're not in the woods here, but a little bit. We can think of ourselves replicating that lifestyle by taking these few hours during the middle of the day to be devoted towards meditation, exploring meditation and meditation teachings. And it strikes me how much that's in contrast to at least a popular view of what goes on in the world out there, where people are out there busy, hustling, working, getting things done, making money. They're doing all the different things that people do. Some of it is just quite beautiful and wonderful, but just so much of it. And here, we're it's kind of taking a break or some beautiful sacred pause from all the need to do and accomplish and be to something that just kind of, that is very different from that. Being at peace with here and now. Discovering some deep peace. And so the process of finding kind of a deep peace or awakening is understood to be a maturing process. It's a process that develops and matures. And the word mature has a number of meanings, but a fruit matures until it's ripe. And often the Buddhist practice is said to a practice that leads to a fruition. So actually the word is phala, which means fruit in Pali. So the maturation, the ripening, it's our ripening, this process. We're letting ourselves ripen on the vine. And When the Buddha gave instructions for meditation practice, which he did in a variety of places, and in the middle length discourses, he has three major discourses where he gives instructions on meditation. One of the primary things those three different instructions have, but the primary things they have in common, is they start off with meditation on the breathing. Being aware of the breath, being short and long, being aware of the quality of the breath, and then letting the breath body become calmer, more peaceful in that process. And then one of those discourses, the Anapanasati Sutta, then continues that process of mindfulness of breathing to go step by step. This ripening process, maturing process, happens with the vehicle, through the vehicle or through the practice of mindfulness breathing all the way. The other discourses kind of seemingly shift the direction of the practice after the initial stabilization of breath meditation has occurred. So here we're looking at breath meditation, focusing on mindfulness of breathing. And I hope that for those of you who haven't discovered the joy, delight of mindfully breathing, I hope that's something that with time you grow into and learn to really appreciate it, its value and its simplicity of it. Partly because so much of our life is connected to our breathing, to the musculature of breathing. And there's so much gets expressed or held in how we breathe. And so, to the degree to which we're not free, to the degree to which we're caught in the world, or afraid, or upset, or preoccupied, it's often expressed in how we breathe as well. And to be able to free up our breath, so the breath feels really free and relaxed and full and at ease, and I think is one of the great pleasures of life. Partly because of the reciprocal relationship, that as the breath becomes more free, then it translates, or it's also expressed in the variety of feelings that come with greater freedom in the mind and the heart as well. So far this year, we've gone through the first three, what's called tetrads, three groups of four. There's 16 stages in this process. And now we're starting the fourth tetrad. And this can be understood to be partly the wisdom tetrad, because it begins with insight into impermanence, seeing the transient or inconstant nature of this life of ours. And one of the primary insights in Buddhism is this insight into impermanence, to change. And so we've been building to this, and part of the reason to build towards this is that it's not so easy to be able to really see change. Two things: not able to see it in all its aspects unless the mind is really, really still, really still and stable. But also, the insight into impermanence is a lot more impactful if the mind is very still and quiet, very concentrated. And you know, the impact of insight, of understanding, is a big is variable. You can understand something without having impact. Someone was talking about this yesterday that I heard. And the example he used was, you know, we all know that we're going to die. That we know. But, you know, most of us, you know, chances are most of us, especially earlier in life, well, you know, we know that, but, you know, so what? So we have the knowledge is there. But if you go visit your doctor and your doctor says, oh, by the way, the test came back and we think you have a week, then you know it too. You know you're going to die. But that knowledge has a very different impact than you're 20 and, you know, yeah, I'm going to die. And so the emotional impact, same knowledge in a sense, similar knowledge, has a different emotional impact at different stages of life, or different contexts. So it's maybe not the best example, but the knowledge, the understanding, the insight into impermanence can have a very different impact on us, emotional impact, you know, liberating impact, depending on the context in which we kind of take it in. And so to take in impermanence when the mind is really deep in meditation, has a very different impact on the whole system and us than if you turn on the 6 o'clock news and the newscast news person says scientists have discovered that this very important principle of impermanence. Well, it's nice, but it doesn't, it doesn't have the same impact. So, the question is, how do we allow these things to be impactful? How do we allow the teachings to be impactful? That's an interesting question for you to think and explore on your own, and maybe even talk to some of your friends about. How is it, one thing is to understand the teachings. The other thing, question is, how do you let them to be impactful, to impact you? What does it require of you so they can have an impact, if you want them to have an impact? So in this line, in this kind of way of talking, it might be interesting to point out that there is a custom in traditional Buddhism, monastic Buddhism in particular, that a monastic teacher doesn't teach people until they really feel that the audience is respectful of what's being taught. And that takes a number of expressions. One is that if the audience is lying down, then you don't teach them. Because if you're lying, unless you have a bad back or something, but if you're lying down, then you kind of fall asleep, you're not really attentive, you're not offering the respect that or if the audience hasn't really asked. This is also kind of an idea that if you're a teacher, you're not supposed to teach until you've been asked three times. And so here at IMC, we just take that as a given. you took the effort to come here. But and it isn't that that respect in and of itself is the point. I think the point is that in order for the teachings to have the appropriate impact, the audience has to be prepared in a certain way, has to be open in a certain way. And until the audience is open. Another example is when the Buddha taught, sometimes to lay people in particular, it's described that he gave a discourse that was kind of a guided meditation, or not necessarily meditation, but he was guiding or preparing the audience to hear some of the deepest teachings he had to give. And so he was manipulating the audience doesn't seem like the right language. But he was it's kind of like I've been told that some sitar players will get up on stage to tune their sitar, before the concert starts, and they're really tuning the audience. So the Buddha's kind of tuning them in. So he gives talks, talks about generosity. And generosity is supposed to, done well, maybe inspires people. Kind of think, oh yeah, that's good, it makes them feel happy and nice about generosity. And then the Buddha would talk about ethics. And, oh yeah, get in touch with their ethical nature and their integrity. And wow, being integrity is a good thing. Start feeling kind of relaxed. Yeah, I'll be, And then they start, it goes through these different things. And it has this kind of effect, mellowing or opening or calming effect. And then when the Buddha discerned that people's minds were soft, open, malleable, receptive, then he would teach them the teaching. Then the Buddha would teach them the teachings which was unique, that is unique to the Buddhas. So all this generosity and ethics stuff, that's not unique to Buddhism. That's just, a lot of people teach that. But it's preparing the ground to the unique teaching. And the unique teaching was always the Four Noble Truths. So here on the Anapanasati, we've gone through 12 different stages of practice that hopefully is beginning to entail a kind of deepening or a ripening of the mind, the heart, the body, so that when we now switch to look at impermanence, that the impact of impermanence can have some beneficial impact, some useful way of for us. That's not just intellectual. That's not just simply a matter of understanding intellectually that everything changes and everything's impermanent, but something else is shifting and going on here.